Have you ever seen him prior to that time? No. Had you ever gone anywhere with him? No. Had you ever spoken to him? No. And everything indicates that it's just the sole word of this particular prosecuting witness. Do you think then there should be a conviction?
Down.
Huh?
The jury's just going to go thumbs down. That's the point.
Well, that may be, but isn't it better to include something in the statute that will afford some protection at least?
Why don't we have this in all our criminal statutes?
Because other crimes aren't based on this kind of
That's the key to it. I mean, the reason we're doing this is because we say, well, you've got a witness here who is unreliable to some extent. Of course, you got this through all your sex offenses too, to some extent. But on the other hand, you've got an individual here who, it seems to me, you are dealing with an area of crime, criminal conduct that involves probably the principal target of law enforcement. Professional organized crime.
You're overlooking the most important thing, and that is that when you have a situation like this that's so explosive, the mere fact that a man is accused takes care of it. The fact that it goes to a jury on an issue like this is a lot worse than a nice simple burglary or something like that. I think there ought to be some requirement for the state at least have a case of some kind before they go, and the uncooperative testimony of a prostitute accusing of him, so-called, allegedly, I don't think it's nearly enough.
Seems like the investigating ability of the district attorney and the police ought to be able to turn up somebody who saw them together.
That's what I would think.
Something else, yeah.
I'll call for the question on the Attorney General's motion to strike Section 5. Which I don't know whether it was seconded, was it?
No.
All right. It was a motion. I'm sorry,
go right ahead. What happened? Did the lifer die for lack of emotion?
Well, I don't know.
French!
All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
No,
this
we'll start all over again. All those in favor of the question will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
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 And I'll move to. Then I'll move to pass Section 5 as it's been amended. It's been amended to show 3 or 4.
Frank, we lost because we were voting.
Call the roll.
Well, I gave my vote before I left, Mr. Chairman. What was it? 7-2?
Dave.
I do have a question. It's just strictly technical. Maybe Roger can help me out. It's the interrelationships of Section 6, Section 5, and Sub 3 of 4.
Mm-hmm.
Section 6, I realize I'm a little ahead of myself, but it's a good fact. It says the wife is a competent witness against her husband in a prosecution of the subsection 3 of Section 4. That's the wife, stepdaughter.
Yeah.
Then in Section 5, I assume what we're saying is that even though the privilege is waived, and as to the compelling of wife, that her uncooperative testimony is not sufficient. Am I correct?
No. 6 shouldn't be in 5.
Well, but Section 6 refers to subsection 3 of Section 4. Waives the privilege, husband and wife privilege, as to that section only.
Wife's. Your privilege is not waived in Section 5.
Now, we're saying in Section 5 that the uncooperative testimony of the wife, even though she is a competent witness, is not sufficient to sustain a conviction under sub 3
right.
Or 4.
That's right. Right.
However, her testimony is waived, and of course, because she's not. The privilege is waived. Therefore, her testimony would be sufficient for conviction if it involves a child or a stepchild under sub 3 or 4.
No.
All right?
No. Well, there has to be some corroborative evidence.
No, but she's not.
There is. You've got the evidence of the child, and you've got her evidence cooperating with the child, and I don't see what's wrong with that.
I don't need that.
If this is what it does, it's fine. I know it's taken, but we do have interrelationship, right?
I think it does.
You can just start messing three sections together.
It's a viable question.
No longer. Just die.
Is there any further?
Yeah, I've got
the response to your question then, Dave, was that in those circumstances, the wife's testimony being uncorroborated is sufficient.
If it's a stepchild or a child.
Yes, if it's a stepchild or...
Well, if the child testifies.
Yes, and therefore it isn't uncorroborated.
It is. Well, it is.
I think it would require corroboration for the wise testimony.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
No, that's not. Yes. No, because the allegation is that the defendant caused the stepdaughter to engage in prostitution. If you bring on only the wife, that'd be sufficient to make a case out of it. Because she is not the one who is alleged to have been compelled to become a prostitute.
You're right.
Yeah.
Stepdaughter,
oh, that's right.
Right.
Yeah, that's
right. You're right.
You don't need the stepdaughter or daughter.
Right.
That's all right. Wife alone take care of
it. Right. But the stepdaughter alone wouldn't take care of it.
Correct.
That's right.
Right. Now the motion.
All right.
I think Frank should be aware of this. The motion he seconded went down to resounding defeat.
Yes, so I understand, but I got a question.
In fact, I announced that it was nailed.
Huh?
That the motion was nailed.
Well, I, to a certain extent in my job, I get used to that.
No, right.
Law and order is in that situation in this day.
Okay.
Under section 6, you've got the situation where a wife can testify against her husband only for section 3, subsection 3 of section 4. And in talking about this section, we discussed that probably section 3 would be a lesser included offense. So that you've got the situation where a wife would be a competent witness if you charged under 4, but if the jury reduced it down to a lesser included offense and found him guilty of a lesser offense, then they'd throw it out.
That,
because
the wife
couldn't testify against her husband under 6.
Why did you wait till we're in section 6 to bring that up?
Well, that's where I thought we were.
No, we're in section 5. We did the top of section 5.
Well, when I was walking in, Dave Frost is talking about section 6.
Talking about section 5.
So I thought you were back.
Walk out
of
the
hall. Would we?
Right,
would
I'll
you call the roll, please, on the adoption of Section 5 as amended?
Oh.
I'm not going to talk.
Well, for the guy. What do you see? What do you do?
No.
No.
Sandra Burns.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Chandler.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Shrock.
Aye.
Jernstead.
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Knight?
No.
Spaulding?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Harry. Now, Frank, we'll come to your section 6.
Kind of an unusual lineup on that, please. And why is it so?
Well,
I figured since they don't have a right to appeal, they got a right to one vote of my
vote. Yeah, right. That's it for them.
I think we should have used up our credit somewhere else.
Mr. Chairman, in section 6, I want to echo, if that's the proper word, what Frank has said. I'm concerned about limiting the wife's competency to a 4-3 prosecution and not extending it to a prosecution under section 3. Because if, in fact, the charge involves a section 3 crime and it involves the wife as a coerced person, it seems to me she ought to be competent there as well.
How about the ownership, control, and managing of the place?
Section 3 is compelling, right? Well, Section 3 is strictly a promotion.
Yeah,
I don't see why the necessity of having the wife
let us
testify.
Let us say that you have a charge that would properly come within 3-4 facilitation, let's say, of a prostitution enterprise or activity. And the wife is the prostitute. And for some reason, it's felt that you can't show induces or causes, but you can show facilitates. And you want to strike the evil. It seems to me that so long as the wife is the person who engages in the prostitution herself, and if you want to make a case about it, it seems to me it's policy, it calls for removing the privilege
in either section.
Yes, and also there's going to be charges brought under section 4, and the jury's going to reduce some of those too, lesser included number 3. And if you haven't had the quantum of evidence necessary for number, for both of them, then the judge has got to set aside the conviction on 3.
On the lesser included.
Well, he would have to set aside it, wouldn't he?
Unless you had the same rule of evidence.
I'm not so sure. We've assumed here that some of the subsections in 3 are in fact lesser included in 4. I don't know about that. That's been mentioned here by Sandra Burns, and I don't mean to disregard his expert opinion.
It's not sound, it's just...
No,
sound just fury.
Oh, I think it is lesser included.
Certainly, if it's lesser included, then this limitation would be, I think, unwanted.
Well, would you suggest that we just say in any prosecution under this article, the wife and the husband doing this against your
husband? And the husband against the wife, we ought to add.
Or a spouse is a competent witness against a spouse.
I don't see anything wrong with that.
I can't see how subsection 2 of section 3 could not just automatically be a lesser included of sub 3 as 1. The language is exactly the same.
Induces.
All facts are compelling.
Yeah.
Now, there may be no as the basis for
this article, is it the list?
Maybe, Mr. Chairman, the Roger or Don would have some reasons why it was put in there, or maybe somebody on the subcommittee.
Well, that subcommittee's got it pretty tough today, but I'm going to talk.
Don or Roger, could you enlighten us a little bit?
Well, I think the reasoning behind it was that our present law makes a wife competent to testify in cases involving criminal acts against herself or the children. And of course, that's where that clearly appears in the draft, is under sub 3 of section 4.
Well, how about sub 2 of section 3?
With respect to...
A spouse is common witness against...
An accused.
That's what we want to say.
Well, wouldn't you say, in any prosecution under this article, spouses are competent witnesses against each other?
Yeah.
Oh, I can.
Right, that's better.
I so move.
Against each other?
Yeah.
Spouses are
competent witnesses against each other.
Do you all understand the motion?
No. Are you being all inclusive now, the entire article?
Yes.
Well, because we have the same problem in section 2.
Yeah. Jim?
I want to make sure, however, that we don't we have the question both of competency as well as privilege.
And
in other words, the present statute says there is a privilege, and then there is a factor of competency. And merely removing the lack of competency will not necessarily make the spouse available as a witness. Because it seems to me you have to remove both the bar to competency and the privilege. Do you not, Don?
Yeah, this is the situation we have now. This does not make the victim's spouse a compelling witness. It's the same situation we have now, that you can, a wife can testify, say if it's rape on a daughter, a wife can testify, but you can't subpoena her and force her to testify. That is, she still has her privilege if she wants to exercise it, but the defendant no longer has the privilege to be able to object to his wife testifying against him.
Wouldn't it be that again,
Frank? Well, the way the situation is now, like Don said, the husband-wife privilege situation, and I'd say if a husband is charged with beating his wife, the wife can testify if she wants to. The husband can no longer exercise his privilege and say my wife cannot testify against me, but the wife still has her privilege to say I will not testify against my husband, so that like you get in rape on a daughter, is another place where you might be using the mother's, the wife's testimony. She can testify if she wants to. He can't object to it, but she can object. You can't subpoena her and force her to testify against her husband against her will.
Okay, let me just get a little bit of legal advice. It's a little bit irrelevant, perhaps, to this. But,
you're asking me.
Got some great legal minds here. Supposing that the husband is being accused of a crime, whatever it is, and the wife, at the outset of the prosecution, had signed the complaint and had given a statement to the police, and then we come along a year later and we have the trial and the state subpoenas the wife, can she invoke the privilege at that point? She doesn't want to testify against her husband. They're back together. Can she now?
Or has she waived that privilege?
Yeah, has she waived it? And, well, that question, can that be answered?
Well, why don't you, here's what the statute says. In all criminal actions in which the husband is the party accused, the wife is a competent witness, and then vice versa. But neither husband nor wife in such cases shall be compelled or allowed to testify unless by consent of both, except where the case involves personal violence upon either by the other or personal violence upon a minor child. In other words, except in personal violence cases in the family, the husband or wife can't be compelled and can't be allowed to testify unless both husband and wife consent, which means that they're not available as witnesses. The husband isn't going to let his wife testify. As a matter of fact, I think it's a mistrial to even call him. You can't even call and make him assert the privilege.
Isn't a more proper place to put this provision is in that section rather than this one?
Well, but
evidently.
But my point is that let's not be misled merely because we restore the wife's competency or the spouse's competency here doesn't take away the privilege. And if you want a wife to be available as a witness for the state, then you've got to take both away. You've got to restore the competency and you've got to take away the
some
privilege.
Place. Maybe some not
place,
here, but
here or someplace.
But isn't that the law, what you read there, the law is that they are a competent witness.
Well, they're competent, except that they aren't competent in most cases, that's what it says.
So the usually common one just says
either
party, either spouse can avail themselves of the privilege to try to form a whole RS.
320.
Well, but
we're not.
Well, all we've done here is, I mean, it used to be that a wife wasn't even a competent witness, but under the common law. But now she, under the statute, they are competent witnesses but have privileges. Right. And all we're doing here is saying that we're abolishing the common law competency of
that's true,
wives. That's all we have said in this section.
Still,
and
in this section.
Anything but the privilege.
I think the better direction. Let's eliminate the sanctified institution of marriage.
Frank,
yeah.
Of course, if we leave this as it is, if we leave this as it is, it makes the wife competent, that's true. But still, under that statute, the consent of both of them would have to be obtained before either one could testify against the other.
So we've done nothing. Because
that's
she's
it, we've done nothing. That's my point.
A husband is a competent witness and the wife is a competent witness already. Without any privilege, you're competent.
I think you could clear it up if that's the policy you want to achieve by saying that a spouse is a competent witness against, spouses are competent witnesses against each other, and neither spouse has a privilege.
Well, neither spouse has a privilege without referring it to anything else, would that be clear that we're referring to this statute?
Why don't we just say neither spouse compels themselves to the privilege provided in ORS, whatever it is.
Well, have we done this in other sections, referred to ORS sections?
Well, the problem is we're writing a substantive provision keyed into a procedural provision.
Yeah.
And we're amending ORS is what we're doing.
Yeah.
I don't think that's good draftsmanship.
Don and Roger, what is your solution to this? What's your suggestion? If the policy is that the privilege will not be present in these circumstances.
Well, it only says one present Oregon statute, 167.625, that special rules of evidence for non-support. Now, they say there that a wife is a competent and compellable witness. Mm-hmm. They take the privilege away in that statute, and that's the only statute in Oregon that does.
Which one is that, Ron?
It's on page 33.
So we want to go halfway.
Yeah. If it were not for this statute that judges read that says a wife is a competent witness or a husband is a competent witness, if it were not for that statute there, under the common law, if a man was charged with a crime and maybe his wife was his alibi witness or his wife was going to testify to some fact, under the common law, she could not be called, even by him, because she's not a competent witness. But she's incompetent. But Frank, she can't testify.
Frank, under the present law, you have two reasons. One is 139.320 says she's not really very competent. And then 44.020 goes on to say that a spouse has a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two reasons why you can't get the evidence.
Well, unless you remove both of them, really, why you're never going to get it.
Really, what we're saying here, by we saying in section 6, that the husband can call his wife as a witness if he wants to. We're not saying anything more. We're not giving the state the right to call the wife. We're just saying that the husband can call.
We've
got to do away with the privilege if we're going to do anything to the statute at all.
Wouldn't that word compel?
Well, like this says, no provisions of law prohibiting the disclosure of confidential communications between husband and wife apply. A wife is a competent and compellable witness. Seems to me that language similar to that.
Of course, if we use the word compellable, that's in 167, then we've eliminated the possibility of the husband having the right and being able to call the wife, but the wife being able to exercise her privilege and say, no, I'm not going to. Won't it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe we can solve it this way. It seems to me that this is simply a drafting matter. The staff
it
seems to me that, and I'll so move, that we amend 6, we instruct the staff to amend section 6 so as to provide that spouses may testify and be required to testify in any prosecutions brought under this article.
Second.
And by that I mean that the state can call the wife against the husband and that she would be competent and compellable, and similarly the defendant can call his or her spouse and she would be competent and compellable at the behest of either party to the case.
Yeah, and if the evidence statute needs to be amended, we'd fight whoever is taking care of the evidence, if anybody.
So,
could you do that during the noon hour?
Yeah, well, that's good, right there.
Let me,
under this article, spouses are competent and compellable witnesses against each other. That is.
Well, for or against each other.
Mm-hmm. Now, not that I disagree with what the judge has suggested, but I want to make clear that we understand what we're doing so it won't come up later that that's not what we meant. This would mean then that even though the wife, you charge a man with inducing or causing his wife to become a prostitute, the wife
doesn't want to testify,
the state can go ahead and subpoena her mm-hmm. and force her to testify.
Like you do under a non-support case now.
Yeah. But you can't do another type of criminal case.
I'll go along with it as it relates to this article, but not as it relates to anything else.
Well, that's all this would do.
I know, but I just didn't want Lee Johnson to think he'd get his foot in the door.
Okay, I want to make clear that even she does not have the privilege to exercise it.
That's right.
Would you read that again, please, John?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, in any prosecution under this article, spouses are competent and compellable witnesses for or against each other.
That's your motion, isn't it, Jim? Does that satisfy Don and Roger?
Satisfy.
Well, for or against each other, or for or against the defendant?
Well, they have to be against each other.
Well, they're not both being charged, usually.
Yeah.
Or against.
Third party.
Probably should be defendant.
For or against either party.
Who happens to be the defendant?
Well, the party is only the defendant.
And the state.
And the state.
Yeah, well, either party.
Yeah, either party to the cause, yeah.
For or against either party.
Yeah. Read that, state that once more, and then we'll vote on it.
In any prosecution under this article, spouses are competent and compellable witnesses for or against either party.
You all understand the motion for amendment? Who made the motion?
Judge Burns.
I did.
And Judge Burns seconded it. Call the roll on the amendment.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Sanderberg?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Har?
Aye.
Frost?
Aye.
Johnston,
aye.
Johnson,
aye.
Knight,
aye.
Young,
aye.
Mr.
Aye. I move we approve section 6 as amended.
Second.
You've heard the motion on the adoption of section 6 as amended. Call the roll.
How can we adopt section
6
as amended?
Aye. We just amended
the instructions.
No.
Oh,
no, no.
Sanderberg?
Aye.
Carson? Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Frost?
Aye.
Junestead?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye. Johnson? Aye.
Knight? Aye.
Spaulding?
Aye.
Young?
All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Carried. Now may we have a motion on the entire article?
Is it good draftsmanship to have this second sentence as we've changed it? A part of the same section as the first sentence is completely different.
Should be paragraph at least, or section.
I knew we reconsidered the last vote.
I voted for it on principle, but I wanted to.
Is there any objection if the staff rearranges this so that they'll have sections 1 or 2 or paragraph?
Subsection.
So yeah, subsections 1 or 2.
But what you're trying to do is to make them competent plus remove the privilege.
My only objection is as to just arrangement. I'm not trying to change anything, excepting that second sentence seems to me that it doesn't belong there, as if it was a part of the same thing.
Rearrange section 6 so that the first sentence will be sub 1 and the second sentence will be sub 2. If there's no objection, it'll be done there.
Move the adoption of the article.
You've heard the motion and second. Call the roll on the adoption of the article on prosecution as amended.
Judge Burns?
Excuse me, Mr.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I was hoping to hear some discussion about the customer provision. Is that dead?
Oh, I intend to make a motion on the patronizing.
I was going to have a comment to make with respect to that. We discussed that with the policeman, and I know one, at least one senator is going to raise a bit of hell because the man subjected to the people's sanctions. I wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Well, Bob, why don't you present your views with respect to that? Why don't you come on up and sit down somewhere? And
well, what we answer his question, I wonder about that. What have we done about that? And nothing. Have
the original draft had a section on patronizing.
And we've eliminated.
It was eliminated.
Yeah, okay.
All right, Bob.
Mr. Chairman, gentlemen, I happen to be a member of the Prostitution Control Committee of the American Social Health Association. And this is a national organization that's active in the field of prostitution control, narcotics, dangerous drugs, family breakdown, and also in the field of venereal disease. And our committee is presently studying this whole topic with a view to possibly recommending a model law, and that's why I was particularly interested in hearing this discussion. About a month and a half ago, we made some investigation in New York. We spent part of a day with the New York District Attorney's Office, also with the New York Police Department, to see just what they were doing in New York by way of enforcement under their present laws. And in reference to the customer law, I'm further interested in it because of the complaints that were made in the Portland area, where white males were coming into the Albina district and importuning and soliciting decent women, and there was a good deal of public protest at the time, which apparently would have been met by a customer or a customer law. New York has retained its customer law, its customer provision, as have quite a number of other states. However, they do not make very many cases on it. But they still keep it on the books and believe that it should be kept on the books because they do feel that it is a deterrent to patronizing. New York also has a new loitering statute which they're using in these streetwalker cases. I think everyone is familiar with the fact that prostitution has changed from a red light district situation to either a call girl operation or a streetwalker. And in New York particularly, it's in fact every major city has a serious streetwalker problem. And in New York, it has even gotten so bad as to reach the mayor's office, and they're putting pressure on the police, and they started making cases under an old loitering statute which went down. So I would think that we would recommend at this time that consideration be given by this committee to retaining or to including a patronizing or customer provision because of the deterrent effect. And also, I have the language of the New York loitering statute, which we are now using in those cases where they do not make actual buys. I think that that provision is an important part, an important tool for the law enforcement agencies in handling the streetwalker problem, which is acute. But I think further than that, this draft looks good to me. I asked the staff to send it to head of the prostitution section in New York, and I don't know whether you've heard from him or not. Have you heard from Paul Kinsey?
No, I sent that. Sent our draft to him, and
he may have not
I haven't
replied,
had any response from
him. It appears to me to be good, and I think it will be helpful to our committee on the national level. And that's all I had to say.
Are there any questions of Mr. Thornton?
Well, I might mention that when John Burns and Roger and I talked to the police officers in Portland about, at that time we were going with draft number one, which has section three, commits a crime of patronizing a prostitute. And there, I think this is a fair statement, their reaction was that that they felt they could enforce such a statute provided they would write in an exception for police, in other words, if they're making a case. And they made the point, which was interesting to me, and it was new to me, that under the present Portland City ordinance for solicitation, for an immoral act, I guess it is, that ordinance, in fact, is broad enough to cover the customer. But as a matter of police department policy, they do not implement it because it means using female police officers as
operatives.
The operatives, decoys, whatever you will, and that the police bureau has not been willing, whoever, chief or whoever, has not been willing to use female police officers for this purpose because of this fear of harm and so forth and so on.
Well, I think they said that in the past they had, and some of the women policemen had been beaten up.
Well, there was one case in Clackamas County they mentioned where they had set a female out as a decoy or some kind, and she suffered a grievous injury of some sort. In any event...
That wasn't a police officer.
No, I guess it wasn't, but in any event, they did mention that, they felt they could enforce such a statute. I think it's fair to say they would be in favor of it, wouldn't it? Don't you think, John, that was a consensus of what they said? Provided that you write in an exception to provide that the police decoy, whatever you call him, himself or herself, would not be prosecutable under the...
Was this taken up at the last meeting?
No, it wasn't.
This was in the original draft of number one, and then, as I understand, the subcommittee...
Who was on the subcommittee? Why was it taken out?
Took it out.
I thought we were. I thought we had voted in committee to draft a solicitation statute in place.
No, no, it was deleted, and I think, well, there were several considerations talked about. One, I think the question that, with respect to having someone who would testify against the prostitute, you would have an incrimination problem with respect to the patronage. That was one consideration. And secondly, that there was an inherent danger of entrapment of individuals.
The exception would alleviate the incrimination problem.
May I say something on that, Mr. Chair? I raised this point with the New York District Attorney's Office and also the New York Police Department. And they say that such an exception is unnecessary because, after all, in a narcotics case, a police officer undercover makes the buy, yet he's not prosecuted for purchasing the narcotics. They say it's not necessary. And I don't think, I think they're probably right on it. The other interesting thing about the customer law is that there are, were two cases in California in about a, within about a year where prostitutes defended on the grounds that the failure to prosecute the customer was a denial of equal protection of the laws under the 14th Amendment. In other words, that if you prosecute the prosecutor, not the customer, this is a denial of equal protection. So this has an added advantage in having a customer law.
Did those go up, Bob? Have they been signed?
I haven't found any record of them going up. I tried to find out about them.
There's certainly a distinction because the prostitute is deriving a profit from it. That's the what I can't see the equal protection.
Well, what's the wish of the committee before we act upon the article as it's drafted? Do you want to take another look at preliminary draft number one?
Well, the question I'd like to ask is, in regard to the advice we're out here, is the problem prosecution? How many prosecutions do they make any prosecutions on the basis of the testimony of the customer?
I don't know.
Very few.
You need a damn unwilling witness.
I have to say, Mr. Chairman, that particularly based upon the experience that we had with the vice officers and what I know personally about the...
Do you like to rephrase that?
From reading the mass media. They seem to think that such a customer law would have a real deterrent from keeping these people out of the Albine area, the guys stopping their car on Knott Street or wherever and flagging women down. And it is a problem about which the black community is justifiably outraged.
Why would that be a problem?
Of course, they made the point also that it isn't simply limited to that. There are two general areas in Portland that were of concern to them. One was the Albina area, and the other is the southeast, southwest area, generally the area approximately one block from the courthouse, and where George Van Humisen made his celebrated arrest recently, and or at least where the chase started. And they make the point that if you have the patronizing statute, this does have a deterrent effect on the male patron driving around the block and walking around the block and so on, looking for the prostitute. And they argue, to the extent that you deter the male from doing that, because he might be prosecuted and his name get in the paper and so on.
Dry up the business.
That's right. You dry up the business and reduce the traffic among the prostitutes themselves. And of course, they also make the point that the social evil, which is attendant upon it, is partly the prostitution itself, but also the other things that go with it, narcotics criminal element hanging around, and the pimps and so on. And they make a very persuasive case for trying to attack these areas in a number of ways. As I say, I do think it's a fair statement that they felt it would be a good idea. They said we feel we can enforce such a statute.
Well, maybe I don't understand. What does this customer law provide?
Well, it simply makes it an offense to patronize a prostitute.
And what does patronize mean?
Don't we have the
This is the way the section is read. A person commits the crime of patronizing a prostitute if he, one, pays or offers to pay a fee to engage in sexual conduct with a prostitute, or two, enters or remains in a place of prostitution with intent to engage in sexual conduct.
Well, I don't see anything wrong with it. How would that be a deterrent to anything?
Well, if you're a visiting fireman from Ontario, let us say, and you're in personal too. Well, all right.
Well, the word is out, and the police have got a bunch of gals out there that are as decoys. I think.
All right. So what's wrong with it?
You cut down the trade substantially.
Well, what's wrong with cutting down the trade?
The only thing that people are concerned about is you're a visiting fireman from Deschutes County. You go into the bar at the Park Avenue, you sit next to a voluptuous young girl, and you say, "Hey, you want to come up to my room for a drink?" And she says, "You're under arrest."
Oh, that's what you mean.
Gets on the AP wire and it's in the bulletin the next morning.
I am bothered about this albino situation we talked about, and if this thing would tend to slow that down or stop it, I think it's a useful piece of legislation.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that concerns me is, and I like the two that met with the vice squad, Grant, former Sheriff Clark could answer it. Is this another one of these laws that we're going to point to so mothers can point and say, "Don't do that, son, because it's against the law," or do they intend to enforce the law? Is this one of those perimeter laws that we hold out to society and say it's against the law, but we're not going to enforce it?
Well, they'll enforce it.
They will enforce it.
They won't enforce it with decoys, as I understand it.
They won't with decoys?
Presently, as a matter of departmental policy in Portland. Is that not right, Jim? But they say that if they had such a law and they would stop a guy, or a man might have to be stopped talking to a woman, and they come up to him as they do now and say, "What's the problem?" "Oh, my radiator's hot on my car. I'm trying to get some." They might just casually say, "Well, you know, there's a new law that makes it a crime for a male to patronize." And so you see an exodus of people suddenly after you get the word out.
As I recall now, I think probably our biggest concern was the Park Avenue. Maybe if we're going to have a cooperating statute, maybe we need one. Any gal could come in and file a complaint against some guy
No, she couldn't, because she'd have to get on the stand and say, "I am a prostitute."
That's right.
Let me read. That language?
The language of that statute is if he patronizes a prostitute.
You have to prove prostitute.
Yeah, you're going to have to prove she's a prostitute. You can't enforce this thing with the DEA.
All right,
this isn't the soliciting statute. This is the patronizing.
Yeah.
Well, maybe this is a better way, maybe this is a better compromise, because if you go to the soliciting, you do, I think, have some real dangers.
About the only people you'd get here is when you made the raid and there were people in the room present, you pick them up.
Well, yeah, but it is a deterrent to other people.
I suppose if you thought that if I go in here and they call the raid, I'm all to get nailed.
Well, maybe the
talking about the
New
Orleans,
the model penal code. The American Law Institute was badly split on this question, and they finally, by a narrow vote, voted in a section on this. But some of these same considerations were discussed at great length in their meetings, according to some of their commentary. But they do provide poor coverage in this area, and they discussed. The ones who were in favor of such a section, that in some respects, not having a section penalizing, patronizing, is really a carryover from the old English gentleman idea that the gentleman shouldn't be confronted on the street and his sensibilities bothered by prostitutes walking the streets, but that it should be available there for him if he sees fit to want it. And in other words, it's, you shouldn't be allowed to sell it, but it's all right to buy it, the commodity. ALI did talk about these other considerations. One, that an impossible problem of incrimination.
Possible green.
And entrapment.
Well, you'd have entrapment problems, but I don't think there'd be anything wrong with a section like this, personally.
I think
it doesn't solve the problem in Albina, though.
Boils down to an issue whether we want to go to the patronizing or the solicitation.
This doesn't solve the problem in Albina, because you've got to have a prostitute involved. Yeah.
You've got to have a solicitation.
The woman that comes in and says, I was accosted by this guy,
Well, we've got, have we taken care of that?
Costing for sexual...
Solicitation is much more important than a patronage.
Well, would you favor a solicitation statute, Don?
What you've already passed, your Pardon? Section.
Would no, you favor a solicitation statute?
I looked at it a moment ago.
Sexual conduct or deviant sexual
conduct. Well, we talked about this question in subcommittee, and George Platt was here that day. And we talked about solicitation as an inchoate crime.
Solicitation.
And that soliciting a person to engage in this crime would amount to solicitation under our inchoate crimes article, because you would be asking them to commit a criminal offense, and that would amount to solicitation as we define that term.
You know, I asked earlier this morning, what would happen if a man walks up to a woman and says, I'll give you $5 if you'll engage in sexual activity. Would that constitute prostitution? And the answer was yes.
That's section
and
two.
And we adopted that.
That's section two.
Now, doesn't that take care of solicitation on the part of, not the prostitute, but on the part of the...
customer.
Yes.
That's 2D.
And so that's in there.
That's in there.
No, it's in she pays him.
You're talking about the male prostitute situation.
You're talking about the woman paying the man.
Page 3.
For the man to...
That's right,
the
male prostitute.
Yeah.
Well, that isn't covered then.
No.
Well, let's have a consensus.
Well, Don is right, though. Under our solicitation of the inchoate crimes, is any solicitation to commit a crime, if it's prostitution, would be...
If prostitution's a crime, any solicitation would be a crime to wife.
Would be the crime of solicitation.
So I think we've got this covered.
So we've got that covered, but we don't have the customer covered.
Here in section 4.2.
Yeah,
you're not a customer covered. He's solicitation. You said no, that would be...
We're treating it as a lesser...
The guy asking.
Probably as a lesser crime.
Bob?
No, that wasn't... that was a different question.
Well,
isn't your understanding that under the court crimes article in this article, if somebody shows up from Nyssa and solicits a moral woman on the street, that he's guilty of the crime of solicitation?
No, because in return for a fee...
A moral woman.
No.
If he solicits a woman who is not a prostitute to engage in an act of prostitution, He is guilty of the crime.
He is guilty of the crime of solicitation. Because he's asking her to commit a criminal offense.
That's right. So we've got that covered.
Yeah,
so solicitation is covered.
In Albina or down on 3rd Street. And appears to be available.
Well, that appearing to be available is not the problem. It's the guy who got out the car window and makes a pass.
Hey, baby.
Yeah, but we're trying to dry up the prostitute's business by scaring the hell out of the guys that might otherwise be willing to go down and cruise around and see what they find. I'm sure they'll be.
Bob Thornton, does that satisfy you? I mean, the solicitation portion?
What's the practical?
I'm not sure.
They're taking the license numbers and writing letters to the homes saying your car was observed at such and such a time at Williams and Russell. And we had to do a crime in this area and sent to Mr. and Mrs.
It's
my squad. A little bit dirty.
Well, that's a different problem.
But we're a lot better than the statute will.
Don,
my car registered in the name of my firm.
With all the names on it.
She opens the mail there.
I'd like to ask you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Don, what section do you point to and rely on for saying the solicitation is present in public?
It's not under this article, it's under our article in court crimes.
Okay. Well, as long as you do have adequate coverage on solicitation, all right.
Because also, prostitution would be treated no differently than any other criminal offense.
I think as part of this package that the committee might be interested in the new New York loitering law that they're using in Times Square now. Where they don't, most of their cases, I understand it, are actual buys. They don't take a case in unless it's an actual buy where the clothesman makes the buy from the street walker. But when the pressure got on Mayor Lindsay was under great pressure from the business community because the streetwalkers were so thick that they were actually damaging the patronage of restaurants and theaters and everything else. They passed this law, it's court tested, and I think it's worth considering because it permits an arrest without an actual buy. And of course, buys take a lot of time, take a lot of manpower. So I'll leave that with the committee and go my way.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
let's recess until 1:30. Pardon me.
That was passive. This was the. This is why we did not. We struck this section was because it wasn't for crimes.
You're agreed on our riot track.
Yeah, we agree that was
an offense.
Well, we've discussed this. Have we discussed this adequately so that we can take a vote as to whether or not we're going to adopt this article?
We've already got a
motion. Yeah. Call roll.
What is the motion?
To adopt the article as.
Without the patronizing.
The whole thing.
Without the patronizing.
Related offenses as amended.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Sandra Burns.
Aye.
Carr.
Aye.
Chandler.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Ross.
Aye.
Jernsky.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Spaulding.
Aye.
Dunn.
Aye.
Aye. We'll recess until 1:30.
By George, we may get some kind of a run.
Tony, you're just pushed
on. We didn't have too much on that agenda after all, did we?
Are you going to get the Rose Room? Are we going to get the Rose Room
again?
I think we can start on page 2. Skip section 1 with the definitions. Most of the definitions in section 1.
This is. We went over this once before, didn't we?
Yes.
We haven't been over this draft. The commission hasn't been over this particular draft. Some of these terms will be.
Yeah. Page 2.
About bribery.
Section 2 and 3 are both official misconduct statutes. Section 2 is official misconduct in the second degree. A public servant, defined in Section 1, to commit the crime of official misconduct in the second degree if he knowingly violates any statute or lawfully adopted rule or regulation relating to his office.
Does that apply to OPA?
I'll go there. I got to get that.
If
it were an oath prescribed by statute,
are you putting a DA in a position where you exercise discretion to prosecute? Hopefully, we talk about it.
Section 3 is official misconduct on the first degree. And it requires an intent to obtain a benefit for himself or to harm another. Public servant commits a crime of official misconduct in the first degree if it intends to obtain a benefit for himself to harm another. Sub 1, he knowingly fails to perform a duty imposed upon him by law or one clearly inherent in the nature of his office. An act of omission. 2, he knowingly performs an act constituting an unauthorized exercise of his official duties. I really don't know. I haven't considered it. I'm correct with questions. Mr.
Don?
Well, that's a difficult thing to answer at this stage. I think the question they want to with this type of crime to provide for forfeiture of office, but if you want to do that, feel that that's another type of punishment that you want to tack on to these, I think you'd have to deal with it in this draft. I don't think that we can treated in our sentencing provisions because each of these crimes, along with all of our other crimes, are going to be slotted into a specific category. And I think some of these statutes that are cited here do provide support.
Yeah, the Oregon Constitution. Competency, corruption, malfeasance, or delinquency in office.
I think an example on your Corrupt Practices Act, where it's
experience has been a company.
Allow for forfeiture of office by a public servant on conviction of a crime or anything like that.
How would you proceed in Oregon under the constitutional provision?
How would you proceed to prosecute under that constitutional provision?
Yeah.
Under anything, I don't know.
Well, a public officer incompetent or corrupt or guilty of malfeasance or delinquency in office may be tried in the same manner as criminal offenses. The judgment may be given of dismissal from office. I suppose you'd file a complaint and refer to the Constitution and cite your facts, huh? How would you start it with the district attorney?
You've got to have a statute.
That's where the state police do.
I think probably what has happened in Oregon is that this simply hasn't been implemented by statute. Although the Constitution says that this may be done, that it, we just haven't done it properly.
Well, I mean,
Rod, what is obtaining a benefit for himself more to harm another? Any type of injury or harm to the, to another, I suppose, huh?
By your conviction.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, one thing that bothers me about subsection 1 of section 3 would be, you knowingly fail to perform a duty imposed upon you by law. You're the judge in the Southern Pacific versus London, and you order the engineer to answer the question, and lo and behold, they mandate you. You find out that you shouldn't have done that. Failed to deny the plaintiff's motion for discovery of the engineer of the Southern Pacific Railroad Company. And I can make a jury argument that you intended to harm Southern Pacific by granting the order for discovery. What's to prevent somebody from filing charges on that case, in any mandamus case. Look at Judge Biggs in the remember the case where he, I forget the name, but was mad about it. Remember that case?
Yeah.
State XRL Rico versus Biggs.
Yeah.
He knowingly failed to perform a duty imposed upon him by law, namely to decide her motion for change of venue. And they took it up and they said, Judge Biggs, you should have decided that. Well, she certainly was harmed. Is that the kind of conduct you're reaching at? Does it knowingly because he...
Was it his intent to obtain a benefit for himself
or to harm her?
Or was it his intent to harm
her? I can argue to harm her. Why should he be fucking?
I can argue like the devil that he intended to harm her.
Well, then, by God, by
getting better off than the sheriff. You've got anything to make that argument on, why it ought to be her.
Well, how do you prove intent?
Oh,
I
said.
We've been using it a lot.
You know,
about
two cigars.
And you're on the consequences of your action.
Well, I hate to see language that at least in terms apply to, and this isn't just judges, any official who has a mandamus situation that's been commonly adopted mandamus as an appropriate remedy. If he doesn't do something, way, you go to court and mandamus. I hate to see writing a statute instruction wherever a mandamus action proceeds, which is in the criminal prosecution.
Does this mean by statute or by
type of law? Knowingly fails to perform the duty imposed upon him by
the law.
Which is, as I understand it, the test of a mandamus. In other words, if it's discretionary, mandamus will not lie. Duty. The office clearly should be performed, they'll mandate it.
But that's a responsibility that we put on the police the last meeting, so that if they have to be not bound over at the grand jury, if he's arrested, and we not bound over at the preliminary the police officer's automatically going to be liable for false arrest. So maybe it's not going to be consistent to.
No, Jim seems to sort of alone. Rest of your face.
If you use another example, you might as well.
No, take a county judge. I'll take any official office. Again, the books are full of mandamus cases.
I suppose this.
Let me give you one here. Inspection of prisons. The county court or board of county commissioners of each county is inspector of the prisons therein. The court or board shall visit them at least once in each regular term and shall examine fully the prison health, cleanliness, and discipline. It goes on. Now, as far as I know, this is not done in any county in the state of Oregon.
Does the grand jury stand in the shoes of the board for that?
For separate statute?
Separate statute.
So every commissioner and every county judge in the state could be
in that deal, though, there's no intent to obtain benefit or harm anyone.
Just the fact that the guy doesn't do something, he's got to get some. It's got to be money in his pocket, or he's got to be out to put you in the jail or something else before he's subject to this statute. Person performing or failing to perform either benefit himself or do harm somebody else, and I don't see why you would create criminal consequences.
Well, where's our article on culpability?
What they're really after here is the guy that doesn't do something and then he gets benefit in the form of payoff or a campaign contribution or something else.
Well, benefit is defined in section.
Why is that situation right there?
If he knowingly violates
that is right. That there's an actual payoff.
We're talking about two, right?
Yeah. But no, we're talking about three.
Well, he intended to benefit himself. He was after votes, you see. So if I do this, I'll get a lot more votes in the next upcoming election.
Well, do we get into a problem by the playing it used knowingly?
No.
Section 3 of the prosecution.
Jim,
let me pose a different subsection. Section 2 says if he knowingly violates any statute or wrongfully adopted rule or regulation relating to his office. Suppose I'm a member of the model city's citizens board, as are 27 people in Portland. Suppose I get up in the meeting of the model city's citizens planning board, or whatever it's called, and say, Mr. Chairman, I move that you immediately overrule your previous ruling, whatever is quoted in the morning paper this morning. And he says, Mr. Burns, you're out of order. I don't give a goddamn whether I'm out of order or not. I demand that you do it. And it's certainly in violation of the regulations pertaining to the operation of that board. Is he guilty of official misconduct in the second degree?
He
He's acting within discretionary authority to decide what's out of order.
Is his intent to obtain a benefit for himself or to harm someone?
Second degree.
The section two.
Knowingly, don't we have to have an added a degree of culpability aside from knowingly? So he knowingly violates
the statute. He intends to violate the statute as distinguished from intending to do the act. This is a specific intent.
But there's an awful lot of minor rules and regulations that are adopted administratively, a violation of which shouldn't rise to the dignity of a criminal offense, in my judgment.
The Board of County Commissioners would be guilty under Section 2 for not inspecting the jails.
If they had, under Section 2, though, if they had the intent to hurt somebody.
No, under Section 2.
Section 2, yes.
Not Section 2, Section
3.
Section
2. Yeah, and if they didn't get back at FS1, when the rules said that they ought to go to FS1.
Yeah, they're not there.
The Illinois statute says a public officer or employee commits misconduct when the individual official capacity commits any of the following acts. A, intentionally or recklessly fails to perform any mandatory duty as required by law, or knowingly performs an act when he knows he is forbidden by law to perform, or with intent to obtain a personal advantage for himself or another, he performs an act in excess of his lawful authority. And then goes, our solicitor knowingly accepts for the performance of any act a fee or reward which he knows he is not authorized, which is not authorized by law. That's getting closer to what we were thinking about in this section. Is this taken from the?
When I closed the tax department and President Kennedy was shot, and was told later that I had no statutory authority to close it because it was supposed to be open on that regular business day, I would have been guilty of this, wouldn't I?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, were you was your intent to obtain a benefit for yourself or harm someone else?
Oh,
you're still talking about doing it? Hell yes, you've been guilty.
Probably deserved it.
DA without proper discretion.
Same thing on failure to prosecute gambling and tobacco violation. Good thing that tobacco thing got is out of the law now. Just gambling.
So those are specific statutes to go to sheriffs and DA.
But that would be comprehended.
If you preferred the Illinois approach, it would be wise to get rid of Section 2 then.
Well, let's not get rid of it so fast.
Well, let's get rid of that rule and regulation business now.
It's a law, not rule or regulation.
I don't mind making them guilty for knowingly violating the statute. But I go too far to make them guilty of a crime.
I suppose if a hearing examiner for the Public Utilities Commissioner in an area that isn't really covered by the statute, but clearly covered by a rule or regulation of the commissioner, violates the rule and regulation, knowing in advance that he's doing it, and that everybody else can count on those rules being followed.
All right, but when you're dealing with rules and regulations, whenever any agency adopts the rules and regulations, given the authority to adopt the rules and regulations, they should also have the authority to take some sort of a procedure against the guy, rather than getting it into the criminal.
Yeah, but suppose the agency doesn't want to. Suppose the agency wants to brush it under the rug and cover it up, and just we poor citizens want to do something about it.
I can give you an example of why I think this, extend this to rules and regulations, would be ludicrous. I know of one county in the state where they've had a terrible problem with the county employees drinking coffee and not paying attention at least to what the commissioners thought was business. So they passed a rule, the Board of Commissioners passed a rule that they weren't to drink coffee in the offices or during working hours.
Now, if somebody sneaks a cup of coffee, you're going to prosecute it.
Drinking single coffee.
Well, that's going a little bit far with the criminal law.
Well,
he'd be violating a duly adopted rule or regulation relating to his office.
Police manuals.
Well, here, what we're doing is that we're delegating legislative authority to those bodies, and we don't know what the hell rules they're going to adopt. And we're making it criminal for the violation of any such rule that might be adopted by some damn fool over in
Condon.
Yeah, but they're making the rest of us subject to penalty for violating their rules. Why shouldn't they be subject to penalty?
That's your district.
Well, I've
had coffee with a judge up there.
He ought to be prosecuted.
But most public servants are under civil service, and they have their own procedures for taking care of those who violate regulations. Even
I move we strike rule regulation off.
Second.
I can see these public servants all voting one way. I'm lost.
I realize, Bob, we're supposed to come up with better criminal code, and if we don't, we'll be charged under it.
I'm going to go for a cross-suggested lunch. Let's just codify the Ten Commandments and quit.
We're doing it.
And let Frost write the charter.
We're having a problem with covet, but I'll tell you.
Well,
Frost,
you know, you're the one that wrote the charter.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Strike the words, or lawfully adopted rule or regulation.
Yeah.
Any discussion? Not all those in favor will say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Carried.
I move we adopt passes.
Heard the motion. Any discussion?
I have one.
We have a discussion.
I think if you're going to delete all the language after statute, we should make some reference to what statute we're talking about.
Well, we say
any statute
related
to his office. Is that how
we've
been?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fine.
Isn't it a statutory duty that state employees come to work day about tomorrow? Isn't it a statute on that?
Just district judges and all candidates.
There's one that applies to all state employees.
I don't know if there is
I think there's a bunch of statutes saying when the office is open and when business hours are, but I don't think there's any statute making it a crime.
Well, I'm really good.
I don't think so, but I wouldn't guarantee it. I just
so the American Commission were gathering information on that in the coffee shop downstairs.
Call the roll on the amendment.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Senator?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Frost?
Aye.
Bernstein?
Aye.
O'Dell?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Pauling?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Where are we on section 3?
We'll be approved as draft.
Shouldn't we have an element of willfulness in this when they take this action?
What's the intent to obtain a benefit but willful?
I guess it is. I was trying to comment.
Well,
what about the DA's and the police discretionary decision making?
The problem I see is
that's not
a benefit. The problem I see, Mr. Chairman, with Section 3 is the words are to harm another. I could live with the mandamus situation and some of the others that we talked about, where a necessary element would have to be the intention to obtain a benefit for himself. I mean, if some judge just goes off Billy Ned and does some dumb thing, he can have a mandamus and do it right. You know, particularly in the field of motion quash and discovery and the other areas in which mandamus is customarily used, but this kind of thing, you're not in there to obtain a benefit for yourself, but you can make a jury argument that he intended to harm the losing party.
Well, if you took the harm out, it wouldn't apply to the mandamus situation.
Well, I think that I don't think the ordinary mandamus case ought to fall within
I don't
to be a crime, and yet
you think anybody could ever successfully file charges and convict the judge and ordinary mandamus thing, even under this statute, adopted.
You never know what might happen in Marion County.
Well, someone tell me, what does harm another mean? I asked that at the beginning.
Wally. Chairman, we spent quite a bit of time on that, and I was trying to check in the comment here. That was not hastily chosen.
The Michigan statute has a definition of harm. Maybe we've got a definition of harm also.
Well, I want to hear what the rest of what Wally was.
Well, that's about it. I'm embarrassed to say, because I don't have the minutes here, and I can't remember, and Roger or Don, if you can remember, but we spent some time on it, and we certainly didn't intend to pick up mandamus, but don't you have to prove mandamus? The judge is ruling, and to make the mandamus, the granting of the petition, the writ, the mandamus, to make that grounds for this, you'd have to prove that he intentionally, knowingly violated the law. And ruling against failing to act is not necessarily knowingly violating the law, is it? I mean, most mandamus cases aren't where the judge says, I'll be doggone, I'm not going to uphold the law. It's a question of what is the law. And once you have a question of what is the law, you couldn't get in front of this statute, could you?
Because you have to prove you broke the letter. Reverse is the Illinois code, which says intent to obtain a personal advantage for himself or another. Harming someone is gaining an advantage for someone.
Well, in the Michigan statute defines harm to mean loss, disadvantage, or injury to the person affected, including loss, disadvantage, or injury to any other person in his welfare if he's interested.
There's always a harm.
Would it happen any, you put the word wrongfully before the word harm?
Well, I think we stayed away from that in our general definition.
I'm troubled all over this. I can think of another instance. A sheriff who closes an interstate highway when he has been informed by the highway department that there is no such authorization in the law. So he knowingly goes ahead and does it anyway because he feels it's inherent in the authority of his office.
Well, it may be that just because the highway department tells him that he doesn't have any authority to do it, he may question that and say, well, I think I do.
Highway department, not the final answer on legal matters in this state yet.
What if it turned out they were right, though?
It wouldn't make any difference. That's why you have all these lawsuits. I think it's immaterial whatever the ultimate decision was. Unless
what
the statute clearly said.
Was he trying to set up a toll gate there and charge? Okay, then he's not benefiting himself. Is he doing it to run the trucking industry out of business? And he's not doing it to harm somebody else?
Mr. Chairman, aren't we after a corrupt act as opposed
yes,
to a
corruption.
Violation? Why not say it conforms corruptly rather than willfully? There has to be more violation than knowingly, so why not use the word corrupt?
Well, some of the other states do use a corruptible.
At least it puts it in its proper perspective.
Well, what is corrupt?
Well, this at least it takes it out of just
corrupt is knowingly failing to perform a duty imposed upon you by law. Really inherent in the nature of your office. That's what it is. With intent to gain some benefit for yourself.
Or to harm another.
Or to harm another.
Verdict says that under some statutes it is necessary that the misconduct shall be willful, or willful and corrupt, or willful and malicious. But in the absence of such provisions, corruption or criminal intention is not essential. The official doing of a wrongful act or official neglect to do an act which ought to be done is sufficient. And I think what we're getting at is something that it's in the nature of corruption.
We've got to give the next generation a tool which to run our government, Mr. Chairman, and that's when they get out of college, well, they're going to have something to fall back on. This is no good.
Those words are harm another really bother.
I think it's just similar to all in the wrong.
What if we just eliminate or to harm another?
Well, then yeah, and make him guilty only if he intended to benefit himself.
Yes.
Well, the problem there is if he doesn't act for the purpose of harming some specific person, it isn't necessarily a benefit to him. To me, that's almost worse than to use an official office to harm some other person than to use it, you know, like, look bad, like I said.
Yeah.
Sims was guilty of this crime here in part. Mm-hmm. Harmed another with a
intent to get a benefit for himself. Yeah, but would he, if we leave off or to harm another?
Well, if we leave, Mr. Chairman, if we amended, provided that the element is if it was intent to obtain a benefit for himself or another.
Mm-hmm. The harming of another would have to be to gain someone a benefit.
I'll move to amend section 3 so as to take out the words to harm in the third line, so as to make it read to obtain a benefit for himself or another.
Well, I have one question. The benefit is defined in section 1 as meaning gain advantage to the beneficiary or to a third person.
Why would you just strike a benefit colon? Strike it.
Yes. I move to amend to put a colon after the word benefit.
Tell me a few more words, and it reads a lot better if you say what you mean on this thing, I think.
Yeah, how can you obtain a benefit for a third party?
Well, because benefit is designed.
Defined.
It means gain or advantage to the beneficiary or to a third person.
I know that. Sounds a lot better if you say it.
Why don't I just leave out obtain A with intent to benefit?
Well, then you could have the sheriff who closed the highway and the people who didn't travel on the highway and get killed because of the weather were benefited. So he would be guilty. I don't understand that. Thank you.
There has to be further definition of the crime.
That wasn't why he closed the highway.
Yeah, it was.
To obtain a bad benefit.
Well, but you're getting away. If you take out the term another, you're getting away from the malicious act. Person using his office to harm another one. The one that comes to mind is the biblical thing of Solomon sent somebody off to war so he could flip this activist. Well, I guess
that
would
do.
Sorry about that.
Well, they would have to prove that this was done with intent to harm someone else. Rogue. Maybe it's all right.
Well, but then, we should be getting into harming another.
Yeah, I say they'd have to show that it was with intent to harm that other one. The benefit was out. Maybe it's all right.
Well, is it covered any place else for abuses? I'm persuaded to your logic, Dave, but I can't. I can't see how we can narrowly enough draw it to. Get away from the objection that Judge Burns has raised. You're kind of like the owl and the rabbit.
Is there a problem with inserting malicious or corrupt? Does it give any more meaning?
Malicious,
didn't
it?
Knowingly and malicious.
Those are terms of culpability that are not in our culpability definition. In other words, we've limited the types of culpability to four kinds of mental state.
What?
Intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence.
Well
intentionally and knowingly are probably pretty close.
We've got intent. Here, that's pretty strong.
If with intent to obtain.
I was thinking of that same word.
Because you can have benefits that are right benefits. What would that do?
He can have a benefit for himself by getting the Supreme Court instead of reversed.
For a wrongful harm.
Right.
we've lived with this 162.510, and I suppose that being said about the same thing as we're saying here.
What does it say?
Well, on page 5, it says any officer that's straight naming everybody, except the governor. Supreme Court and the legislature.
I'll get out of that. I knew they'd be out.
Who,
the word I have motion.
Who takes any fee for any official duty except for committed by law, or who willfully neglects or refuses to perform any duty or service pertaining to his office with intent to injure or defraud anyone, or the injury of anyone, whether the injury was particularly intended or not, shall be punished and so forth. We got that in our books a long time ago.
Oh, I don't think I've heard it.
Nobody's ever heard of it.
Subsequent legislature.
That's because the legislature left out of them.
Nobody's heard of it.
We could just amend that to include the circuit court.
Would you restate your amendment?
Oh, maybe I'm...
He would do it.
Maybe old Chandler's talked me out of that. I don't know. Well, I agree with what Dave says, though. It's really, if it's the kind of a thing you're really striking at, it may be that the harm in the action is not the benefit to the official, but
that's right.
Detriment of some citizen.
And if that's the intent of it.
I think it's all right as well.
It's all right. Otherwise, he's worse than the other guys.
You bet. Why would it hurt to insert the word wrong?
Well, we just haven't been doing that.
Because we don't have the word wrongfully defined anymore.
To find it.
We'll have to go back to that.
If he knowingly fails to perform a duty, but we don't raise hell with him, if he knowingly performs an act which he shouldn't have performed.
Right.
Like the county tort building the highway up to his ranch house.
Up to the judge's ranch house, Martin Hardy.
Doesn't subsection 2 cover that?
Performs an act constituting an unauthorized, I suppose.
But
yeah.
At the end.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Well, take the JP over, the municipal judge over here in Independence that issued the warrant when the fellow wouldn't pay his water bill. Remember that case, Utley versus City of Independence, and he stuck him $5,000. That'd be official misconduct, suitable for the criminal arena.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
I doubt it, because I doubt if he paid the $5,000.
Yeah,
I think he did. He had an appeal bond up.
I mean, they sued the city and got
sued the city and the judge.
Got fired.
More, look at this more. I think it's probably all right.
Move we approve section 3.
Without the amendment.
Without amendments.
Your second?
Yep.
Got it. Any further discussion? Motion is to approve section 3 as written. Call the roll.
Judge Burns?
Pass.
Pass. Sanderberg?
Pass.
Or no Trump?
Aye. Are you asking for reasons?
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
No.
Ross?
Aye.
Drinsdale?
Aye.
Padil?
No.
Knight?
He voted aye if he was here.
Falling?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Carried. Section 4.
Pardon me.
Thank you.